This year, for the first time in human history, 1 billion people will go hungry. As prices for basic grains skyrocketed last year, millions of people were unable to purchase sufficient food. Riots and protests erupted all over the world. These dramatic headlines have faded, but the crisis remains. La Via Campesina, a global movement of peasant farmers, believes that the latest food crisis has exposed the disaster of the global food system. And they have a solution that they believe will feed the world and cool the planet. It's called food sovereignty. Annette Demaret has worked as a technical support for La Via Campesina since the movement emerged in 1993. She's a professor in the Department of Justice Studies at the University of Regina, and she joins us from there this morning. Annette, hello.
Hello.
La Via Campesina held its latest international conference last October, and I understand there was a lot of discussion about the food crisis and its root causes. What were people discussing around the root causes of that? Why are so many people going hungry?
Well, La Via Campesina essentially argues that there are some really long-term causes to this food crisis and also some, you know, much more kind of shorter-term causes. And the long-term causes, I mean, they had actually pointed to these some years ago in the early 1990s, actually. And it was partly because they had had experience with the structural adjustment programs that had been implemented in a number of countries. And those structural adjustment programs, which were really based on a neoliberal ideology, fundamentally altered the rural landscape and also, of course, disempowered small farmers in their ability to make a living on the land. And what I mean about when I say structural adjustment, it actually was turned agriculture into kind of a structurally adjusted kind of agriculture, where food was treated just like any other commodity, and therefore was placed on the free trade agenda. And so, in the year before the WTO opened its door, the Via Campesina was formed, and it did that. It formed this international movement because they knew that putting food on the free trade agenda was going to spell disaster for small producers and also for the health of a food system. Because what it meant was that governments then would start concentrating on increasing production and increasing that production specifically for export. That was done at the expense of production for domestic consumption. So in the process, what you had then were fields, you know, acres and acres and acres that were normally planted to food for national production, for domestic consumption. Those were replaced by acres and acres of broccoli, snow peas, mangoes, flowers for northern markets. And consequently, countries that used to be self-sufficient in certain basic grains were then becoming net importers of food.
Tell me how the organization La Via Campesina developed an alternative model. Did that emerge from what was traditionally in place, or was there another approach?
Oh, well, their analysis demonstrated that not only was this process of, you know, structurally adjusted agriculture taking place, but that the policies of the international institutions like the World Bank and the IMF and also national governments were in fact encouraging the globalization of an industrial model of agriculture. And that's the production system which very effectively distances production from consumption, so consumers have no idea what it is that they're eating. And they have no idea about how that food is produced and who produces it and the conditions under which it is produced. And, it essentially leaves us with a food system in which food crops kind of disappear overnight from fields and then they're kind of deconstructed and then reconstructed by a number of industrial processes. And then they appear on the shelves of supermarkets in kind of really brightly colored packages with a tag that says may contain, okay? And that was the model that was being globalized. And so farmers, in this system, farmers are completely displaced. It is a model that gives far more strength to industrial players, because what those industrial players do is essentially enter the food system and lengthen the food chain and try to extract profits along every link of the chain. In that process, farmers are pushed, are fundamentally marginalized, because what the industrial players want to do is access whatever raw products they need at the lowest price possible. So La Via Campesina, sought to turn this model completely around, which it did by developing this concept of food sovereignty.
So tell me more then about the concept of food sovereignty. What's meant by that?
Well, can I just say one more thing about the causes? Because
yes.
I was just talking about the long-term causes, but the short-term causes, of course, were the fact that you had the entry of speculators into food markets. You know, with the housing mortgage crisis in the USA, what happened was speculators, hedge funds, moved their investments away from real estate and placed it into the futures markets for commodities like grains and other food products. Okay, and the other main kind of shorter-term cause was the fact that you have this agro-fuel boom, where fields that used to be planted to grains for people, we're now producing grains to make ethanol, essentially to feed machines. So that was creating an artificial scarcity, which helped, of course, to increase the price of food. Okay, now to your question of what is food sovereignty all about? Well, it completely rejects this neoliberal idea of the right to export. Essentially, it seeks to radically transform food production, food distribution, and food consumption. It's central to the idea of food sovereignty is the idea that peoples have the right to determine their own agricultural and food policies. And to do so in a way that ensures the well-being of their populations. So it's not only about governments defining agricultural policy. It's about ordinary citizens, people who both produce and consume food, being involved in determining all kinds of issues around the production, the distribution, and the consumption of food. So essentially, it focuses. It's got a number of kind of key principles, and one of them is that it focuses on producing food for people instead of food for animals. Food for animals that are produced in intensive livestock operations, that kind of thing, or instead of producing food for machines. Okay, the second key principle is that it really focuses on closing the gap between food producers and food consumers, and because it involves producing for local consumption, then it helps to cool the planet, because as we know, the production and transportation of food over long distances, of course, demands a whole lot of fossil fuels and therefore contributes to green gas emissions. And producing for local consumption avoids this and can therefore contribute substantially to actually cooling the planet. The third key principle is that it puts those who produce and consume food at the center of decision making on agricultural and food policies, and that's instead of giving over decision making powers to kind of faraway institutions like the World Trade Organization, who that really do not experience the consequences of their decisions. Food sovereignty localizes that decision-making, therefore making everyone more responsible, more accountable for the decisions that they make. Now, that can be done through, you know, the creation of policy councils, local, you know, other kinds of local governance structures that determine how communities will grow and access food.
Annette, what kind of changes would have to take place for food sovereignty to be achieved?
Fundamental transformation.
Yeah, we're talking about the world food system.
In the way that we think about food. In the place that we give food in our cultures. It really speaks to some fundamental shifts in how we think and how we are around food. I think in Canada, food in many ways has become less and less important as an expression of culture, for example, and that would need to change. Food is at the center of our lives. You know, food is not only central because we eat it daily, we absolutely need it, but because to produce food, we're talking about the environment. We're also talking about how it can be central to our culture and to also social relations. So it really does demand a very different way of approaching the way we are around food. And I think that's what's so exciting. The other exciting thing about food sovereignty is that it's going to be different in different places. There's not, you know, it's not a, because you have, because it empowers local people to make decisions about how that food is produced, where it's produced, and what is produced, and at what scale, then that means that it's going to be different in different places based on the kinds of cultures that people want to promote or to build. So it is central to food sovereignty is this idea of diversity also. It's not something that it's going to be the same in Java as it is in Canada.
What do you think that people could do? So if people are listening to you and they're kind of making the connection that there has to be a big shift in their thinking around food as consumers of foods, what steps could they make to change their relationship to the food that they eat, which you describe as so important and central?
Well, I think the further away you can get from eating industrial food, the closer you're going to be to achieving food sovereignty. That is, you should know what it is that you're putting in your mouth. And right now, if somebody is eating Captain Crunch for breakfast, they're not going to really know what's in that Captain Crunch. And it's a highly there's a new study that just came out this week about the high levels of mercury that have been discovered in products that are made by with high fructose corn syrup. And high fructose syrup, corn syrup, is found in virtually, in an awful lot of processed foods. So one of the things that you want to do is move away from foods that you don't know what it contains. Okay, the other thing that you want to do is make sure that you know who produced the food. So farmers markets, community shared agriculture, are two ways that you can that are relatively easy shifts to make, and that actually would allow you to be involved in some aspects of food sovereignty. The other key way to start working, to start building food sovereignty, is to work at trying to build a local governance structure, like a food policy council. I mean, I'm just using that as an example. It can be something else, you know, but something that allows you to get involved in a discussion of what kinds of policies, should municipal governments and provincial governments and national governments be putting in place to foster food sovereignty, rather than, you know, some of the existing policies that we have, which are so destructive. Because the thing about the food crisis is that it's not only a food crisis. We're in a part of the history of the world where at a point in the history of the world where we're faced with an environmental crisis, an energy crisis, and a food crisis. And so somehow, food sovereignty can help us to resolve various aspects of those various crises.
Well, it's been great talking to you this morning, Annette. I really appreciate your joining me.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you. I've been speaking with Annette Desmarais. Annette is the author of La Via Campesina, Globalization and the Power of Peasants, published last year.